Welcome to Chatter on Books. I'm your announcer, Jamie McIntyre. We attempted to come up with a creative introduction to the show, but our writers are on strike. Here's Tori Klein.
Welcome back to Chatter on Books. We are socially distant in so many ways, and tonight, thanks to Claude's wonderful work, we are coming to you via Zoom this time, and Michael Kornheiser from South Carolina, David in his party attic. And we've got some wonderful people on the show tonight and some important things we want to do. David and Michael and I need to do a little recap of how we're all doing, what's going on in our respective worlds on with coronavirus and COVID-19. Michael's going to give us a quick virtual book club on Station 11.
So sorry.
Yeah. You cannot get to this now without reading or hearing a reference to Station 11 and how depressing it is. In our never-ending spotlight on indies, we really want to help our local independent bookstores. And so Lori Gilman, who we all know, we've been with before at East City Bookshop, is with us. And she's going to talk a little bit about what they're trying to do in these very trying times to take care of their customers. And our featured author, I am very, very excited about this. He might be our first PhD. Dr. Natwar Gandhi, who is a very familiar name for many people in the DMV, because he, along with Mayor Tony Williams, but he gets a lot of credit for taking DC, which David and Michael and I know very well, and Claude, from desperate financial situation to a very good financial situation. And he's pretty famous and infamous in wonderful ways for that. He has a remarkable personal story, and he has a wonderful book called Still the Promised Land. So we will talk to him. And finally, Deserted Island, instead of taking books, again, trying to help our local independent bookstores. We're going to talk about our favorite local independent bookstore. And Lori, of course, yours is top of the list. But David, let me start with you. How's it going? You're starting week three. How's it going?
Yeah, again, if this is the biggest sacrifice my children and I have to make, I mean, come on. I'm in a house. I'm in a house that has food in it and it has electricity and it has Wi-Fi. So really, come on. we've got paper towels. We've got toilet paper. You know, I mean, there's so much going on out there in the world right now that terrifies me. And you know, so we're doing fine. The kids are fine. We're all fine. You know, I'm just so moved by the daily deluge of stories you see and read about people that are just so desperate, you know, and I know everybody's paycheck to paycheck essentially in this country, but it's so tragic because every day it's a new sector of the economy that you didn't think of. Macy's is laying everybody off, I guess, that works for them now. And it's just awful, you know, and I just feel terrible for so many different people who have it so much worse than I do. So really, I'm fine. We're fine.
Yeah. Well, it's good to hear. And you're right. Every hour you think about somebody else, you hear about somebody else. I was listening to something on the radio today about, we're of course thinking about the doctors, the nurses, the ER people who are incredible, and they are brave. It is the definition of bravery to go in and doing what they're doing every day. And then you think about the people like the janitorial crews in those buildings. They have to keep going in and trying to clean, and they don't have any more personal protective equipment than anybody else. And you and I always talk about how people throw the word hero around, and we talk about quarterbacks as heroes. Mm-hmm. People are heroes. Absolutely. Right. Okay, Michael, South Carolina, you decided about a week ago, right?
Yeah, this plan was sort of always in place, just figuring where my in-laws live. There's just a little bit more space. There's a little bit more freedom for the boys. Because right now we have two toddlers. We have my nephew is down here as well. And really for them, it's inspiring because their life hasn't changed at all. And in many ways, no matter what you see on the news, it still feels, you know, very distant from me in the selfish sense that I look to my immediately family, and it has thankfully not touched us yet. And, you know, to David's point, you're just looking at how we fast forward and you see how this continues to exponentially go further and further into our future. And you just think about the economics. We're all very lucky. My wife is able to work remotely. I obviously have a very flexible work-life schedule with my dad. My dad is thankfully safe for now, and PTI is looking after him, and we're able to sort of all check in on him as we do these phone debriefings with Nigel's help and Sean's help up in New York. So, you know, I get a few hours every day where I try and unplug, and it's really great to see the boys because they remind you of so much of what's positive. So right now we have almost an early summer down in South Carolina, and even just watching the alligators, watching the birds, watching the tides change every day, it's really good to sort of reset and try and recalibrate how I try and just watch the march of time and try and balance out all of the bad that I'm seeing on the news and really all the anxiety that you see when you even make a simple trip of, this is my decision. I'm going to the grocery store. I've got X amount of people to feed. I'm trying to meal plan so I don't have to do those trips. And I'm also trying to look out for somebody across the aisle. There's a huge population over 65 down here. Yeah. And I look at these couples and I'm wondering, where are their kids? There's obviously the question of, are your kids joining you? And is that selfish unto itself? But as I'm trying to make sure we've got food and all the goods we need and the medicine, I want to make sure their carts are filled too.
Yeah.
Yeah. We, on a very small scale, we were trying to help out. I think I may have said this to Michael, trying to help out a local food pantry. And they give you, and they have on Facebook, a list of the things they need. And we spent, Devin and my daughter and I spent hours driving around in Virginia trying to find a few bottles of ketchup, trying to find rice. Rice is a very big deal. Flour is a very big deal. And it was remarkable how difficult it was. This is rural, rural Virginia. And it was also just so profound how much these people needed it. The food pantry out there has had a huge demand. People need it. They do not have work now. They don't foresee having any work 2, 3, maybe 4 or 5 months from now.
Right.
They need that bag of rice. It is unlike, Dave, you and I talked about this yesterday, and I want to ask you about sports, and then we'll go to the virtual book club. This is unlike, we've all lived in the DMV for a long time, and we've seen a lot of things, and we lived through 9/11 and all that. This is unlike anything else.
Correct. No, there's nothing to compare it to, even 9/11, which was catastrophic. But again, as I've said many times to you and other people, I'm sure, and you've said this to other people, it was two cities, essentially, right? I mean, it was Washington and New York, and it was awful for us. But in Denver, life went on pretty much the way it went on the day before. So this affects everybody in every community in every part of this country and in most countries around the world. There is nothing that anybody who was not alive and sentient in 1918 can compare this to. Yeah. This is new territory for all of us. And so my one hope is that we recognize how fragile our lives are on this little planet going forward. And that we maybe take a second to think about somebody else going forward other than ourselves, and maybe reach out to other people that might need help that are either too proud or aren't capable of asking for it. And be aware of where you are in the world and try to impact the world in a positive way.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I realize there are far more important things going on than we didn't have March Madness.
Yeah.
Professional sports is done. But talk a little bit, as you and I were talking yesterday, talk a little bit about the mid and long-term implications for sports. And of the major professional sports, who do you think is going to be okay? And who do you think is going to have a bigger challenge here? Dr. Gandhi and Laurie are listening. And Laurie knows this, Dr. Gandhi, but we talk about books a lot, I promise. We just
That's circuitous. Hang with us. We're coming to you. I think all the leagues will be fine. I think hockey will probably have it a little harder than the other major leagues because they depend so much on their in-gate revenues. They don't have as big a TV contract as, you know, the NBA does or baseball or the NFL. So those sports, it's not that they'll be fine. It's that they have more cushion to kind of hang out for a while. But, you know, I don't know that it's going to be a while, I think, for any team sports. I just, you know, again, it's all of these leagues have at least 30 teams. That's 30 teams in 30 cities. And the chance that any one of those 30 cities goes offline or spikes at any given point in time in the next year. I mean, how can you not? That has to be possible, right? So being able to predict, I think, will be very difficult for these leagues. And so I do think there is a chance, and I'm sure Michael can speak to this better than I can, an individual sport like golf or like tennis, you have far fewer people involved. It's one guy, it's one woman, it's one caddy with one bag. You don't have to have any family there. You certainly don't have to have any spectators there. You can social distance. I mean, it kind of lends itself to that. Tennis is in a certain way also. I think they have a better chance of getting back online sooner than the team sports.
So, Michael, talk about golf. Masters pushed off. Did they come up with a new date, or have they not yet come up?
They have not, but those inside are looking towards October. So very famously, Augusta National closes in May and is closed through the summer, and it comes back in September. And it has historically been a winter's sort of getaway club. It's a national club. So they have the capacity to host it in October. And you look at what else is on the schedule. The PGA Tour wants these majors to happen so they can flex stuff in and out. End of September, early October, you have the Ryder Cup. So you can work with that. And I think the biggest issue for them would be, could you get the golf course up to the speed that you want? Because they do use different kind of grasses, but with all their sub pumps and their temperature controls, I mean, it'll look different. You won't have the colors of the azaleas. You'll have the colors of fall. Mm-hmm. But I think the symbolism of what those majors mean with regards to the changing seasons and the calendar, they're going to do everything they can to get Augusta ready, I'd say, for that October. At first, you thought, well, would Augusta flex and go into that May spot? Because at first, we didn't know how quickly this would spread, and you figured maybe you could try and have something in this relatively smaller southeast city. But then you see what's going on in Atlanta. So that's the easy one. I think what happens to, say, the U.S. Open, they've already stopped all the infrastructure and they've closed down Wingfoot. And you think about Wingfoot, it's a mile away from the epicenter in New Rochelle. You look at Royal St. George's, what's going on in that part just outside of London. I mean, these happen to be four locations, three if you sort of exempt Augusta, that are very close to these big sort of epicenters for what's been spreading. But I do agree. You think you get all the reports every day about so-and-so on X staff of Major League Baseball team is self-quarantining or has these symptoms. And you just realize how big these entire staffs are and how hard it'll be to predict that. So, I mean, it's only natural that you're going to see some sport that tries to come back prematurely. And hopefully that's not the case. But I do agree with DA that you could look to golf, you could look to tennis, particularly as you get to that late summer. But there is a lot of time between now and late summer.
Yeah. And again, there are people with far bigger challenges than professional golfers, many of whom have been in this for a while and have made some money, hopefully banked some money. But if you're a professional golfer and you were really getting ready for the Masters, and just listening to you and your dad talk, I know there's certain players like the Masters versus that course and this course, and there's certain players who were really getting themselves positioned for the Masters. Now you don't know when you're going to play again in a competition. What do you do?
So what's, I think, really responsible, if you pay attention to Rory McIlroy and a lot of the guys in Southern Florida, you take care of what's important, which is not just your health, but the health of the general population. So go follow Rory on Instagram. There's obviously the powerful Nike promo that he's been sharing, but you can go follow him on his Peloton. I know, Tori, you're into the Peloton. The European Tour had a great message, so if you can find that on Instagram, I think it is just about the role we all play in this. Uh-huh. But it's easy to look to the top 20 players who might be trending in the right direction, but think about some of the fringe players who are just trying to qualify for status so that their career extends 2 to 3 more years into the twilight years so that they can try and make the Champions Tour, so that they can try and continue to earn gobs and gobs of money. I mean, we saw the story of DL3's house burning down. You're seeing stories of players just trying to make enough money so that they're eligible to play, say, in the U.S. Open. And I mean, this is not just for, say, the PGA Tour. Think about all the qualifying tours around the world where when there is the chance to play, those are going to be the first tours that lose their ability to play because they're going to try and swing that date to something that they deem more important.
So from the sublime world of golf to the terrifying world of Station 11, the book you months and months ago, I will remind everyone.
Right.
Maybe we should wrap this up, Michael, because it's getting...
I'm moving away. I'll start with this. Let's look a little bit at characterization. And I know I wanted to talk about our young actress, but I really think based on how quickly sort of this virus has come into our lives, we have to look at individual characters because you're starting to see individual characters who take the stage and can handle the stage and those who can't. And I'm going to start with an interesting twist here and actually go to the prophet. So think about names. What's in a name? And think about why we have someone who is named the prophet. And I would, if we were doing sort of a mapping exercise, I would have you look for direct and indirect pieces of evidence that are going to help us sort of create the picture in our mind of this character. So direct, what does he say or do? Because a lot of what we're hearing is indirect from other people telling us what he has done or how he's behaving or what we're gleaning when we're looking at the movements of this group. So as we're trying to narrow down those direct and indirect pieces, I think it works for breakout groups to try and figure out, well, why would we allow a personality like this to take shape or to grow? And even if we look at our own life, we start to look, well, should we have stepped in sooner for other large personalities? And it's easy with our distance. But as soon as you're on that ground and you look at what can we weaponize, whether it's information, whether it's access, or whether it's actual physical weapons, I think that comes into play when we look at this prophet. And sort of right now, you know, no matter who we're with, you take a look at our news daily briefings, and you're trying to take a look at individual communities, and you're looking at the mayors, and you're looking at the governors, mm-hmm. you're looking at the people on the ground, the first responders, the doctors. You're seeing all those stories of nurses and doctors going into their combat zone, and you're seeing the op-eds that are coming out of this. And I think it's impossible to ignore, you know, the briefings that we're getting from Fauci and from our president every single day. So I would focus on the prophet, and I'm not going to go much more beyond that, because I think there's just a lot of unpacked as we try and take that prophet and transpose it into our own world, and trying to think in our given communities, how would we handle something like that, even if it may not be as extreme as that individual personality? I mean, you're seeing all these stories when we talk about the term herding, and you're trying to think, well, I never would sort of think through that way when I'm talking about my fellow man, my community members, those who need me the most. But then you're hearing very, you know, very sound economic arguments in it, and it's very dispassionate. So I think that comes into play as well.
Yeah, okay. I think it's fabulous, and I'm simultaneously just in trance when you ask these questions and you bring up these discussions. And I think to myself, every single one of these applies to what we're going through right now. I mean, the whole notion of taking the stage. Everybody, as David said, everybody has a role to play. Everybody has a role to play in this, whether that it's the president, we'll put that in a separate category, these governors, these mayors. But if can you reach out and do something for your neighbor? Can you find that bottle of ketchup for the food pantry, right? Everybody has a role to play in this. But it is terrifying.
Terrifying. And again, I'm sorry.
Yeah, never again. Never again. You might get to do the virtual book club again, but David and I get to pick the book. Okay. Lori Gilman, owner of eCity, you still with us?
I am.
You were in the store, boy, just weeks ago, it seems, with Jeffrey Rosen. And I think we were kind of chuckling that Michael had picked the book, Station 11, as his virtual book club. And back then, we were all starting to hear about precautions and things people should be thinking about and washing our hands. And things, especially for you and local independent bookstores, have escalated dramatically. So tell us how you're doing, how the store's doing, the kinds of things I know you're trying to do now to continue to serve your customers.
Yes, we are. Well, right now, our staff is all, everybody's fine. So that's good. Everybody's families are fine. So that is all good. Yeah, it's hard to imagine. I think when you guys were here last with Jeffrey Rosen, I was talking about Jason Reynolds and Ibram Kendi for their new book, Stamped. And we did manage to have that event, which was great, but it was getting, it was starting to look a little precarious at that point. And so that seems like it was about 3 years ago at this point. But we have, in the last couple of weeks, come up with pretty much all new business plans about three times. And right now we are doing shipping and local deliveries within 2 miles, and our community and all kinds of people who like bookstores everywhere have been incredibly supportive. We actually have had so many orders that we have not been able to keep up. Tooling everything so that we're now a little mini fulfillment shipping center. So it's been interesting.
But it's good. And the community, your customers, the community are stepping up and trying to patronize you, right? Even though it's hard.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, one thing that was interesting we realized is that once schools closed and public libraries closed, and I don't know if everybody knows that, you know, Amazon prioritized some items over others. So they're not shipping out books for a good month, at least. So we've, in a lot of ways, have become even more important, just as far as, you know, looking at the fact that, oh, having one huge entity that takes that is in charge of everything might not always be the best way to go. So one little bit of bright lining.
No, that is a bright lining. And I get, again, I can understand some of the things that people desperately need, but still, what are people ordering? What are people reading?
Well, we've sold a lot of Station 11. The good thing is that she has a brand new novel out, which we have sold a lot of those as well. And it's not, it's completely different from Station 11, but it's wonderful. And it's about kind of scary characters, but in totally different ways. So I was a little bit afraid that, you know, her next one just couldn't live up to Station 11, but it's great. We've sold lots of kids' books, lots and lots of kids' books.
People want to read to their kids.
We are in a huge Bears phase down here. We've saved all of my wife's books from when she was a kid, and Walker refuses to take his nap. He just wants to read Trouble with Grown-Ups.
Oh, that's so cute. That's great. Yeah, we have been selling a lot of all kinds of stuff, and we really have had a lot of people really miss the community and kind of being a gathering place. So we're trying to think of ways to bring people together in some form. We've had, we have a lot of book clubs, so we've been doing virtual book clubs. We've had, we're doing deliveries around the neighborhood. It's interesting because we still have all our employees. We're paying everybody, and there's lots of work to do. But people are delivering books around the neighborhood, and of course, putting it, you know, on the step and making sure that someone sees it, and people come running to their doors and like, hi, thank you, how's it going? You know, people really want to chat, which is very nice. And my youngest daughter is finally learning to drive because she's been driving me around to do book deliveries.
Excellent. It is just amazing. I think the first time we were up at your shop, I think it was David Epstein. And one of the things we talked about then, that was back in the summer, was that one of the reasons local independent bookstores were doing better is because in this age of technology, people were reaching out, looking for that human connection, looking to be with other people from their community, in their community. And you guys are such a great gathering place. And I can see where a lot of people who built that up with you are now starving for the interaction.
Yeah, one of our book buyers had a brilliant idea, which was a book hotline. So we do have a book hotline, and that has been really popular. And that is just for, you know, not to ask about your order or anything, but just to talk about books and get recommendations. And I can give you that number if that's okay. It's 202-539-2554.
Say it one more time.
202-539-2554.
Great. So just hypothetically speaking, if my small nuclear group was ready to start killing each other, we could call the hotline to get recommendations on books we could read to settle us down.
Yes. Yes. And you can get them for things you could read aloud for the group or for the adults and the kids, or, you know, we got everybody covered.
Yeah, we might need it because we've killed all the jigsaw puzzles. Lori, thank you so much for joining us. I know you are swamped and you must be exhausted, but glad you guys are hanging in there. Glad we can do something to help put the spotlight on you all. And stay in touch.
Yes, okay? Thank you. We appreciate it very much, and keep it up.
And stay healthy, okay?
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, back to our PhD, Dr. Gandhi, if he's still with us.
I am.
We all know you as this very sophisticated, very buttoned up, very articulate guy who took one of the most disastrous cities to fiscal responsibility. But take us back to where it all started and where you were from in India and what your childhood was like.
Sure. Perhaps you know, in the book I have said that I grew up in an extended family that included my parents, grandparents, aunts, uncle, other aunties, and seven siblings. In addition to this basic 14 people, we also had people who would come and live with us for a long period and then go away, and then others would appear there. It was a rather primitive little place in Western India that had no running water. I remember my mother and sisters carried drinking water from over the town river. No electricity. I studied under a kerosene lamp. No paved roads, no telephones, dogs and cows everywhere. Of course, no cars. Right. Basically, it was a place that had, you know, practically nothing in terms of modern civilization. So when I hear about all these issues, things that we will be missing during this coronavirus catastrophe, people talk about toilet toilet papers and all that. Well, I lived first 25 years of my life without toilet papers. So in that respect, I would be doing all right. Nevertheless, our little town had no jobs, nothing to speak of. So my father put me on a train to Mumbai when I was 17 and asked me to take a job and help him financially. So, and only through a sheer miracle, I was able to come to America with the help of a friend in 1965. Mm-hmm. With just about $7 on me.
It's not a lot. Yeah.
Right. And then I studied. Eventually, I got a PhD in accounting. And I taught at University of Pittsburgh. I understand you are from that area.
Didn't you live in North Park?
Right. Yeah. Exactly right. Ellison Park. Right. And then I came to Washington just for a year. But I had this Potomac fever, illusion of doing important things. Once you come to Washington, who wants to go back to Peoria?
But let me interrupt, because let's go back
yes.
a little bit back to your childhood. You somehow figured out how to get access to books, and you were inspired by important figures.
Right. So our little town had basically nothing, but they did have a library, a ramshackle library. You know, nothing to speak of, just few books and some places to sit. And I was able to read books and, you know, books of Mahatma Gandhi, Abraham Lincoln, and people like that. And that inspired me a great deal. And I was also able to look at the magazines. And even in those days, in those little towns, we used to have American magazines.
You remember which magazines?
Time and Life. You know, it was quite a an inspiration to look at those magazines. And eventually, you know, we thought that it would be a good idea to go to America. And here I am.
Pretty amazing. Okay, so you come to D.C., you become a tax wizard, you become sought after, and you moved into a really, really important role under Tony Williams when he was the chief financial officer.
Right.
Run the tax office. And so just to give you of how horrible the situation was when you took that job, can you tell the story from your book, Still the Promised Land, about looking in the closet and finding all the tax returns that weren't opened?
That is right. And in the early in my tenure there, within a matter of, you know, 1 month, you know, I wanted to get acquainted myself with the office. So I used to walk around office and try to meet people. And one day I said, let's see what's going on here in this office. And we opened the door and there was nothing but unopened tax returns filled in bins from floor to ceiling. And my God, I said, nobody's going to believe this. So I invited Tony Williams to come down and look at it. And we took pictures of it because nobody would ever believe this. And I have pictures to show that these were the thousands of tax returns that were never opened. And I'm sure there were checks in them as well. So it was really a very big mess. And if you cannot keep your tax returns in proper order, if you do not file them, how would you ever know who paid taxes and who did not? So we had citizens in the district who did pay IRS their taxes, but did not pay us. You know, their attitude was, well, if you pay our taxes, thank you. And if you didn't pay, we also thank you, because that was no way we were going to go after you.
Sorry to interrupt. I don't want to speak for David or Michael, but I wish I had known that back then. I have lived here for a long time, and I have dutifully paid. I paid my taxes year in, year out. How did you fix it all? Tell us how you addressed it.
Well, it was a massive effort, and Tony Williams was a very big supporter of our tax office, because he knew that first thing we need to do is to fix the tax office, because that's where you get the money to do anything else. So we introduced new systems, hired new people, and I hired people from IRS who were retiring. And since at the GAO, General Accounting Office, where I worked, I used to audit IRS. So I knew practically every commissioner in my life there. And I went up there and they said, okay, we're going to help you. So I hired some people from IRS, and it took us about 5 years. We matched our records with IRS, mm-hmm. and then discovered those who were paying our taxes and who did not pay our taxes. And we went after those people. We went after businesses that did not pay our taxes. And eventually, we started collecting taxes and received cash in substantial manner, such that we started developing surpluses. So when I joined the city, it had roughly $500 million of deficit in our fund balance. Mm-hmm. When I left the city in 2013, late 2013, early 2014, it had about $1.7 billion of surplus. And today, before the coronavirus, it had about $2.7 billion in surplus. Was doing extraordinarily well before the coronavirus. Yeah. Coronavirus is another issue now. We're going to suffer close to $500 million revenue loss because everything had to be shut down.
Yeah. If you were CFO right now, the District of Columbia, what would you be focused on right now? What would be your top priority?
Well, our top priority, of course, would be to protect our revenue base. And, you know, after 9/11, we had a similar problem mm-hmm. where we lost about $300 million of revenue because the airport had to be shut down. You know, the city was in disarray at that time. So what we had to do is basically estimate the losses in our revenue and then try to adjust our expenses accordingly. So we had to revise our budget and say we are not going to be able to spend money because we don't have money coming in. And obviously we had to have help from the federal government. Federal government has not been kind as far as the coronavirus is concerned to the district. They did not treat us as a state, even though our revenues are larger than a few of the states. Yes. Population is larger than some states. Nevertheless, we are treated as a territory, and we would not get as much money as we should receive from coronavirus debacle. Yeah.
Okay, so speaking of debacles, you took the unusual position of opening the book with a story about what you've described as the biggest problem, the biggest crisis in your professional career. Betsy, who's the Chatter on Books fan community on Facebook, had emailed a few questions, and she was really interested in that. And she says, how did you recover from that, which you've described as the worst professional moment in your career? But I'll refer to it as Harriet of the Shoes, and you can describe what happened.
Well, what we had there is that, you know, over 20 years before even I joined the city, city's financial department, tax department in particular, was in disarray. Mm-hmm. We did not have the ethics and culture of honesty, of fiscal probity, of making sure that we don't spend more money than what we take in. But more than anything else, our control systems were not proper. We did not have systems.
Right.
Unfortunately, even though we introduced new systems, the seasoned employees there took advantage of lax controls and stole away roughly $50 million over 20 years, and we did not know about that. Obviously, as the head of the tax office once and also the head of the financial office, it was my responsibility. And I took responsibility and said, I am the one to be blamed for this, but I'll fix it. Mayor at that time said, yes, we'll give you a chance to fix this. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did. What we learned from that was that we must have proper control, but more than that, we ought to have ethical culture in our employees. So everybody had to take an ethics course. That these are public funds, you are steward of public funds, and you must protect public fists. And hopefully we eliminated that. But, you know, what happens is whenever there is a cash involved in there, mm-hmm. there is always a likelihood of something happening. So you have to be eternally vigilant to make sure that everything is taken care of, that proper amount of taxes are received, and that expenses are properly controlled.
Yeah. And why did you refer to her as Harriet of the Shoes?
Yes. She was Lady of the Shoes because she had hundreds of pairs of shoes. She had a credit account at Neiman Marcus. And simply go and splurge money over there. Millions of dollars.
Nice. All right, well, let's get you out with this last question. So there's never enough time, but you were educated in the South. You got your PhD in the South, and then you moved to Pittsburgh. You experienced racism in the South.
Yes.
You encountered all sorts of nightmares in academia, because anybody who works in academia knows there are many nightmares there. And then you've dealt with a lot of corruption in your government roles. You handled it very well, but you dealt with a lot of corruption. Why do you still refer to, and why do you believe that this is the promised land? And what makes you so optimistic?
Well, two things. One is that this country, as you know well, is built by immigrants. And it is open to immigrants like me. And it gives an opportunity to work hard and prove yourself. I understand the latest news is always about immigrants not welcome and all that. Eventually, this country and its people open their hearts and open their doors and let immigrants come in and work here. Second is that we in this country need immigrants, because at one end, we need people to work in our fields and farms and factories, in our houses, in our construction, etc., that we do not want to work. We need people to work there at the lower end. At the higher end, we need people who are highly skilled in technology. And without them, we would not be able to maintain our technological edge.
Yeah.
So this country makes it possible for people to come and work here. And people around the world want to come and work here. And we let them come in. And that is why I think this country will always be on the top. I know we are going through all these horrendous problems, particularly now, and we are questioning ourselves. But I assure you that we are going to come out with this shining. We are going to be the city on the hill, shining city on the hill. Remember after the Second World War, when Pearl Harbor happened, and at that time, same arguments were made about our being unprepared. And we were unprepared. But see how quickly we were able to come back and prepare ourselves and ultimately turn victorious. I see the lesson in there. And I guarantee you that if we were to hold this same podcast in another year, and if you invite me, I guarantee you I would be singing America's glory again.
Excellent. We will definitely invite you back. Station 11, I feel better already. Dr. Natwar Gandhi, it's an honor to speak with you. Thank you for all you have done for the district and the DMV. And everyone really should get this book, Still the Promised Land. It's wonderful. It's inspiring. It's the stories are remarkable from your upbringing, from your education. Really remarkable. So thank you for joining us. Stay healthy. Keep your family healthy. And we do hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation to speak with you.
All right. Take care. There are so many stories in that book. He encountered... He was educated and taught at historically black colleges. That's where he mm-hmm. could get in. And mm-hmm. there's so many things he did. Anyways, fabulous guy. I'm glad we had him. Okay, so Deserted Island, in our continuing saga to help our local independent bookstores, we're going to do a shout-out. And hopefully next week we'll have a couple special guests who will do shout-outs to their favorite local independent bookstores or one they just want to give a plug to. And then we're going to tag them and do everything we can. So, David?
Yes.
I love it. By the way, those of us, because we're not going to have video of this, thank God. David and Michael not shaving. It's a good look.
Oh, God, no.
I've got a lot of white in the beard.
Yeah.
I look like I should have a Geiger counter and be combing the beach for some you're right. talking about. This is awful. But I don't know. I'm trying to decide whether I'm going to have a poll whether I should shave or not. I'm not sure.
That's the future. Okay, what's your favorite? It doesn't have to be the favorite, but if you were going to take a local independent bookstore with you to the deserted island, which one would you take?
No, I want to shout out. I've talked about this store before, and I hope at some point we can maybe do a show there, and that's Sankofa Books in Northwest.
You send my emails or my phone call.
I know, they're very busy over there. They're very busy, very busy. I love them. It's right across the street from Howard University, and like
like we heard earlier, every independent bookstore right now is just getting hammered. Just think about this, you know, a school or a bookstore in proximity to a university, you certainly have an expectation of a large amount of income coming from that university. And now that university is shuttered with no idea of when it's going to open. There was a video conference call last week, about 200 independent African-American book owners and bookstores in the country. I'm just talking about whether it's the digital divide and the closing of library, all these different things that really, that independent bookstores really try to fill the void for, it just becomes even harder. So a shout out to Ms. Garima over there, who was the owner of the store and all the work that they do. And one day they will return an email or a call of yours and we'll be over there.
Okay, Michael.
This is pretty easy. I wish that I could send my dad out to Rehoboth and he could be recording solo shows from the browse about, but we know that's not the most responsible thing. We've all these messages from these resort towns, but the browse about has a little bit. It's right on Rehoboth Ave, and many of us in the DMV have spent some time out in Rehoboth. And whether you're stopping by for the morning paper, a cup of coffee, some little trinket to remember your stay, looking for the latest bestseller, looking for their staff recs, which are amazing, or just looking for a quiet place to take your kid to get out of the sun and play with the train table, they have a little bit of everything. And I'm thinking about, as we extend this forward, you're trying to think, what is the, you know, song of the summer, movie of the summer, book of the summer? Every summer, BrowseBout adds to their front facade. They add the sort of book of the summer. And some, you sort of shake your head and grin. It's, you know, the Dan Brown historical thrillers. It's a 50 Shades of Grey type of year. And you just wonder what is going to be up on 2020 when there's a good chance there's really no summer. It's important, even if you can't get out there, to try and support all these independent stores. And it'll be, you know, they've adapted in every sort of way we see these stores. So I imagine they will continue to do so. But, you know, I'm thinking of them. And in many ways, I wish I could just send my dad out to Rehoboth and hunker down out there.
Fingers crossed. And they are, you heard Lori say, and I've heard some of the others say this, we're coming up with new business plans every day. They reinvent themselves in ways they never imagined. And some of them, I think, are going to come out pretty well on this. One thing she didn't talk about, but Libro.fm, if you like audiobooks, you don't have to get them from Audible. You can do Libro.fm, and then the money goes to your local independent bookstore. So mine is the Penguin Bookshop, which is in Swickley, Pennsylvania.
Of course it is.
It's been there since 1929. It's been there since 1929. It's had about four or five different owners. It was started by two ladies who clearly had nothing better to do. And they called it Penguin Bookshop after, maybe Michael's heard of this book, Penguin Island by Anatole France. Very strange thing in which it's a colony of penguins and a guy, kind of a prophet, or he thinks he's a prophet, shows up and he thinks the penguins are humans and he's trying to convert them. It sounds absolutely fabulous. But they too, nobody's allowed to come into the store. So they're doing deliveries, they're doing online orders and they're shipping these kinds of things. So we wish once, maybe. Okay. David, Michael, thank you so much for this. Everybody stay safe. Wash your hands. Claude, thank you for making everything happen. Everybody, please take care of yourselves. Send us your ideas, info@chatterandbooks.com. Review us when you can. And we hopefully will come back next week with Alexis Coe, who is an author. She's an historian. She is a writer. She has a wonderful book out called You Never Forget Your First, A Biography of George Washington. In the midst of everything else, we should be talking about people like George Washington. Thanks, everybody.